Most stories do not start with a journalist. They start with people noticing when a river runs dry, asking why a school is changing, discovering something new next door. Curiosity is human. Your right to keep asking questions is at the heart of NPR's mission, and we are not going anywhere.
Told to stand up, put my hands behind my back, handcuffs on, and I'm taken into custody.
Jane Daratic's life had taken a dramatic change from just the day before. Her husband, Bob, had gone missing on a run. Then his body was found by the side of the road. Sheriff's deputies were investigating the death as a homicide, and now they'd claimed they found the culprit. On February 16th, 2000, 2 days after Bob's body was found, deputies got a search warrant for Jane's home. Remember from the first episode, they had already been in and out of the house dozens of times. It's not usually the best police practice. But now they had an official warrant. They searched Jane's house, focusing on her bedroom where the blood was found. Then, on the evening of the 16th, the whole family was gathered in the living room. There was Jane, plus her two sons, Alex and Nick, her daughter, Claire, Claire's friend, Sean, Alex's girlfriend, Nicole, and Jane's sister, Bonnie. Here's how Bonnie later described what happened in court transcripts. Detective Rick Empson and Janet Rudzinski came in and asked Jane if she knew how or why there would be any blood in the master bedroom. The detective's theory became that Jane was motivated by marital problems and money issues, so she killed Bob in the bedroom by beating him on the head. Then she dressed him in his running clothes, dragged him out to her truck, drove him to the side of the road, and left him there. And that theory would dominate the next 20 years of Jane's life and shapes who she is today. Before Bob was killed, Jane was a middle-class white woman who assumed the criminal justice system worked just fine. Now, she has become a hardcore criminal justice activist. And even now that she's free, she's devoting her life to going to protests, rallies, conferences, all advocating for ending life sentences completely, even abolishing prison for women entirely. Jane's story also highlights a massive change in how murders are investigated and prosecuted. Her husband's murder came during a time where science was big in the courtroom, with a lot of experts who analyzed blood spatter patterns, bite marks, tire tracks, gunpowder residue. But now, 20 years later, much of that scientific analysis has been found to be, well, not very scientific. In Jane's case, her initial defense attorney didn't contest any of the quote-unquote science presented by experts. And what eventually won her freedom was an incredibly methodical and careful analysis of each scientific method and the way the experts were sloppy. But Jane didn't know all of that back in February 2000. All she knew then was within 3 days, she'd gone from working with the detectives to being led away in handcuffs. Jane's sister Bonnie said detectives told Jane they were going to get a search warrant, that the master bedroom was closed off and no one was to go in there. Bonnie asked the detectives if Jane would be able to sleep in her bedroom that night. And they said it was gonna be a long night, and I said, you know, will she be able to sleep in her own bed in her bedroom tonight? Because this has been really hard for her and she's already really traumatized, and I wanna know if she's gonna be able to sleep in her own bed. The detectives said it was unlikely. Jane began realizing the detectives might be looking at her as the suspect, so she made an offer. She said she'd take a polygraph. So they went down to the car to take Jane to the station for a polygraph. But her sister was telling her over and over to wait and get a lawyer first. That's when she changed her mind and said, I need an attorney. And at that point, she was placed under arrest.
At 10 o'clock, they're happy. How is she dead 2 hours later?
When a San Diego police officer is found dead in her home, who investigates? Follow One of Their Own, a new podcast from KPBS wherever you listen. For the San Diego Sheriff's Homicide Department, this was shaping up to be a high-profile murder. And this was just 2 years after a different bungled murder case attracted a media circus. In 1998, 12-year-old Stephanie Crow was found stabbed to death on her bedroom floor. Her 14-year-old brother and two of his friends were initially accused of the murder. A year later, during jury selection for the trial, police found they'd made a mistake. They found Stephanie's blood on the sweatshirt of Richard Tewitt, a man who was unhoused, addicted to drugs, and diagnosed with schizophrenia. The DA did not want something like that to happen again. They wanted to lock in a murder conviction, and quickly. They charged Jane with murder, and everyone prepared for trial.
Part of what makes it newsworthy is that, you know, we look for people that people can identify with.
This is Onel Soto, who was assigned to cover the trial for the San Diego Union-Tribune.
And so part of what made this newsworthy is that it was a couple that were living not exactly in the suburbs. I don't know that Valley Center is a suburb, but it's certainly a well-to-do part of town.
It's a prominent equestrian community.
They were, you know, horse people, so there's interest there because of that. She's an executive, so she's not just somebody who's had a life of crime. It's got this mystery to it in terms of, you know, it's entirely a circumstantial evidence case. Nobody says, I saw her do it. Nobody says, there's no confession. So it was interesting from that perspective in that, you know, it had a lot of pieces that are that were attractive as a news story.
As Onel sat in the courtroom, the evidence looked quite damning. The prosecution went one by one through a mountain of scientific evidence. They said tire tracks near Bob's body matched those from Jane's truck. Rope was found around Bob's neck, and it matched the type of rope found at Jane's house. They looked at the contents of Bob's stomach. It was partially digested dinner, which they said meant he was killed Sunday night after dinner, not Sunday morning after breakfast when he went on his run. They detailed all the places that Bob's blood was found in and around his and Jane's bedroom. On a wooden stove in the bedroom, on the walls and floor, under the mattress. And maybe most damning, they said they found Jane's bloody fingerprint on a syringe filled with horse tranquilizer.
You have this evidence that is like something out of a crime novel. You have, you know, a bloody fingerprint on a syringe with the dead guy's blood inside the syringe.
Quick note, Bob's blood was not found inside the syringe.
You know, you have these three tires that are, that they don't match on a pickup truck with tires from three different manufacturers. You have this rope that appeared to be, that was found on him that was also, it existed at the ranch. And you had this bloody scene that was cleaned up, that where there was so much blood that it dripped through the floor onto stuff below.
Jane had hired a private defense lawyer named Carrie Steigelwald, and he faced a decision: push back on this evidence, the way it was collected, the way it was tested, the science it claimed to follow, or accept the evidence completely and come up with a different defense. He went for the second option, to come up with a different defense, and what he picked was truly bizarre. Jane told our producer about it over Zoom.
So my daughter came to visit and she said, Mom, Carrie and Dennis, the investigator, they have a plan and we want you to go along with the plan. And Carrie and Dennis say, if you go along with this plan, there's no way they're going to convict you. And that part of it sounded good to me, but Claire never said to me what the plan was.
The plan was to blame Claire for the murder, to accept the prosecution's argument that the murder happened in Jane's bedroom, but to say that Claire was the one who did it. The defense hinged on tricky family dynamics. Jane's two sons favored their father, while she and her daughter Claire were really close. Again, here's Onel Soto, the reporter.
So before any trial starts, the lawyers will try to clear up some of the issues so that they don't have to do that in front of the jury. And one of the issues was Carrie Steigerwald said, I need to blame the daughter. I need to have the instruction saying I can blame the daughter.
Carrie Steigerwald wanted to introduce into evidence a letter Claire had written to her father, Bob.
He had introduced the letter from Claire to her father saying, you know, our relationship is over. Things have to change. I'm not going to take your abuse anymore. I mean, those are my paraphrases of it. But that letter that he introduced, that was also a bombshell in terms of not only now do you have a woman accused of killing her husband, but now you also have her daughter accused of killing her father. I mean, this is stuff that goes, you know, into Greek tragedy mode, into Shakespeare mode.
Before a producer hits record or before a journalist picks up a pen, someone like you notices something and wants to understand it. Every day, we invite you to keep asking questions like why and who and how. Because NPR begins with questions, not conclusions. And your right to curiosity is a right worth protecting.
Adding to the Greek tragedy Shakespeare-ness of the whole thing was the fact that Jane's sons testified against her. They told prosecutors about what happened when they visited their mom in jail.
So he's visiting her in jail. He's saying, hey, what's going on with this bloody syringe? What was it about? And she didn't answer him directly. She said that, you know, she was afraid that everybody would start questioning her. So that was used by the prosecution as, evidence of her guilt because, you know, here she has an opportunity to tell a loved one that she's not guilty. And instead of answering that question, she says, I was afraid that everybody would start questioning me. Now, what does that really prove? I don't know, but I think the more important issue is you have a son who's willing to believe that his mother is a killer to the point where he is testifying in her trial against her.
Today, Jane still doesn't speak to her sons. And when our producer asked her about them, she didn't want to say much.
It's heartbreaking and it's hard to talk about. I blame the lies that I know they were told by the detectives in my case. And I know it because I listened to audio tapes of what they were told. So it's really all I'm going to say about it. It breaks my heart.
She didn't want to talk about her sons, but is very willing to talk about her case.
I want to be open and upfront about all of what happened to me in the hopes that it can help prevent it from happening to someone else. I often feel like, and say this to some of my peers who are involved in criminal justice reform, it often feels like you beat your head against a brick wall to change things, you know? It's a tough uphill battle, but mostly people are just not aware because they don't think about the prison system.
It's not a spoiler to say Jane's defense's plan failed miserably. The science held up in court, and the jury did not buy the idea that it was really Jane's daughter who had killed Bob. Her original defense lawyer, Carrie Steigerwald, didn't respond to interview requests. But we did speak with Jane's latest defense attorney, Mike Cavaluzzi. He believes Jane is innocent, but he also says he will defend people he isn't so sure about.
And if I don't think the truth is on my side, then I really want to focus on the burden of proof and how high that burden is and whether or not the prosecution can meet that burden. And I'll focus on that.
He says the quote unquote blame the daughter strategy is never something he would do.
What I tend not to do, what I almost never do, I may have done it very early in my career when I was first trying cases and found that it really does not work, but certainly I've never used it in a serious felony, is where I fabricate a defense that my client doesn't believe in, that I don't believe in, and that feels like it's pulled right off of some corny television show. That's not something that I would normally do. I am extremely, I like to believe that I'm a very creative lawyer and that my mind is open to all sorts of possibilities and defenses. But I don't approach it as something out of Law and Order or LA Law or some other crime show. I mean, I really focus on the case and how best to present the truth as it is and not some Agatha Christie story.
The jury didn't buy the Agatha Christie story. After 3 weeks of trial, on June 5th, 2001, they began deliberating. It took the jury a week to make a decision. When they came back to the courtroom, they announced they had found Jane guilty. She was sentenced to 25 years to life for the murder of her husband, Bob, a man she'd known since right after college, a man who was the father of her three kids, someone she'd weathered all of the ups and downs of marriage with. But after her sentencing, she never gave up.
For the whole time that I was behind bars, and even when I was first sent to prison, I had this sort of overwhelming feeling that Bob is just going to show up somehow and rescue me from this. I mean, I had dreams about it. I felt like somehow he was gonna come back and rescue me from this, and the truth would come out and it would all be over.
Next time, Jane's life as a prisoner. Free Jane is hosted by me, Katie Heisen. It's reported and produced by Claire Trageser, sound design by AMFM Music, additional producing by Laura McCaffrey. It was edited by David Washburn and Terrence Shepard, web design by Brendan Tucinardi, and our news director is Terrence Shepard.
On KPBS Midday Edition, we're connecting communities through conversations. You'll hear truth around the leading issues and the leading controversies with historical context, along with perspectives that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. Listen to the Midday Edition podcast wherever you get your podcast.